the Moment Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. We're all doing things we've never done before to get by while managing the dangers of COVID-19. And California lawmakers are no different, but this legislative session showed that not even a pandemic can cure politics of partisanship. Plus, since you can't still see a movie in L.A., John Horne has decided to take a Vegas road trip to see Tenet. He'll tell us all about it. It's all ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Ian Martinez. Thanks for joining us on a Tuesday. Coming up, it's going to get hot again this weekend. We'll tell you what it means for the potential for wildfires in our region. Plus, an update on the shooting of a black man last night by sheriff's deputies in South LA. All that's ahead. But we start today in Sacramento, where state lawmakers yesterday closed out their last day of legislative session. After a hectic night, the state legislature approved and shelved various bills whose fate now lies in the hands of Governor Gavin Newsom. Here to fill us in on those bills and the session is KQED politics and government reporter Katie Orr. Katie, all right, let's start at the Capitol, where amid a pandemic, the session was quite different from years past. So how was it different and what was the climate overall?
Oh, it was crazy. The biggest change was that most of the Senate Republican caucus had to take part remotely. And that is because last week, Senator Brian Jones from San Diego County tested positive for COVID. And he had been in close contact with most of the caucus, all but one member, actually. So Senate Leader Tony Atkins made the call that these members should not come to the floor, that they should vote via Zoom from their homes or their hotels, whatever, and proceed that way. The Senate Republicans did not like this plan. They were very angry about it. And as a result, there were some tensions that just spilled over into the proceedings all throughout the night.
Katie, you know, I have some friends in sports media, and, you know, when I text them, they're talking about how they miss going to the ballpark, the energy that all the fans, all the people running around brings. Wondering if it's the same kind of dynamic up at the Capitol in Sacramento. You know, I would imagine there's, you know, especially during these times, there's hallways that are packed, people running around, deals being done. Is that something that is just not there, and are you missing it?
I mean, it's completely different. Like you said, normally the halls are packed with lawmakers. There are staffers hanging out, reporters wandering around till like the wee hours of the morning. I mean, I will say it is a lot of times the Capitol Press Corps, after everything's done, will gather and have like a drink somewhere. And there's some kind of camaraderie, and you don't have that this time. Instead, I have my 3-year-old and my baby trying to get my attention while I'm watching a computer. So it's different, but I can be in my pajamas. So
you can still have the drink, though, Katie. I mean, that's not completely off the table. All right. So, okay, a handful of bills have made it to the governor's desk, ranging from eviction relief to police reforms. Let's start with police reform. What were some of the biggest takeaways?
So this was really interesting. There are two big bills that got through. A bill that would require the attorney general to investigate all police officer related shootings that result in the death of an unarmed civilian. It takes those investigations away from the local city or county and puts them at the state level. And there's another one that passed that bans chokehold and carotid artery restraints, the same kind of hold that was used to kill George Floyd in Minneapolis. But there were two big bills that didn't pass. And it's really interesting why, because they simply ran out of time. So one of the bills would have decertified police officers that are convicted of certain serious crimes, you know, taking, they say, quote unquote, the bad apples out of the bunch. And another would have banned projectiles and tear gas, would have banned their use by police to break up protesters. But as we mentioned, last night was the last night of session. It was the end of a 2-year session. So the deadline is in the Constitution. They had to be done by midnight. And because of all the delays we've seen throughout the year, because of procedural issues, they simply ran out of time. And so some of these bills just weren't brought up.
And I know there was a sense of urgency, especially from police reform advocates, to use the momentum of the last few months to get some of those done. Why could it be problematic that some of these reform bills didn't get heard? And what happens next from here on those?
Well, that's it's just what you're saying. Momentum is such a huge part of politics. We've seen bills in the legislature this year that haven't moved in ages suddenly get traction now. For instance, the ballot measure to reinstate affirmative action in California, that has languished for years. But this year, because of the racial injustice in the country and the conversation we're having, it got pushed forward. So you risk losing that momentum. And because, again, this was the end of a two-year session, there's no letting a bill hang out in a committee or shelving it and reintroducing it next year, a little bit down through the process. You have to start from the very beginning, and it takes a lot of work.
I know some were hoping that maybe Governor Newsom would bring them back. Democrats don't seem to be too, they haven't really weighed in on that idea. I know that was more of a Republican ask, but is any chance that Governor Newsom might do that?
I honestly don't see that happening. Of course he could. When you bring people back for a special session, it has to be on a specific issue. So they would have to take, there would have to be something weighing on them that they felt really couldn't wait until next year and bring everyone back and just tackle that. For instance, I believe Jerry Brown did it on transportation funding at one point. But I don't see that happening again, because all of the pressing bills, there doesn't seem to be that momentum again. And a lot of these lawmakers are facing tough elections right now. They don't necessarily want to be up in Sacramento having to deal with this legislation that could likely wait until January.
Talking to Katie Orr, politics and government reporter for KQED. All right. Also got an update on AB 5. That's the labor law requiring many independent contractors to be classified as employees. What's the latest on that one?
So a bill went through last night, AB 2257, that really grants exemptions for a lot of people in the music industry. They're also writers, photographers, editors, illustrators, to give them exemption from this rule. AB 5, of course, is the law that comes from a Supreme Court decision in California saying that if you basically reclassifying who can be called a contract employee. And the crux of the decision was, if you are performing a core service of a business, like Uber drivers driving, that's the argument, that they have to be called employees and not contractors. Of course, this throws the app-based world up into a huge disarray. And there is actually going to be a ballot measure on the November ballot, Prop 22, sponsored by Uber, Lyft, and I believe DoorDash as well, that would create basically a third category of employee.
Now, there were also a handful of COVID-19 related bills, including an eviction relief bill, which Gavin Newsom has already signed into law. Can you break down that legislation for us and explain what it means for renters and landlords all across California?
Yeah, this was a hard fought, hard negotiated deal as well. It basically extends COVID-19 related eviction moratoriums through January. And what it says, though, is that if you have lost your job or can't pay your rent because of COVID-19, you basically have to go to the court and swear on penalty of perjury. So it's pretty serious that this is the case. And then you can get some kind of rent relief. In this case, let's say you can't pay your rent beginning in September. You, through January, have to pay 25% of it, whether in a lump sum or overtime or whatever. You have to pay 25%. And as long as you pay that, you cannot be evicted. And if you missed rent in the spring, you don't have to pay any amount of that. However, that is just to prevent you from being evicted. Landlords in this legislation can take you to small claims court to try and get that money back. The argument of landlords is that, you know, they count on this rent to pay the mortgage for those buildings. And there was not any significant mortgage relief in this legislation for landlords.
That's Katie Orr, politics and government reporter for KQED. Katie, as always, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, now to last night's fatal shooting of a man by sheriff's deputies in South Los Angeles yesterday. It happened in a neighborhood called Westmont, tucked right near the intersection of the 110 and 105 freeways. Now, for a closer look at what happened, we're joined by KPCC's Frank Stoltz. Frank, first, what prompted the shooting?
Well, sheriff's officials say two deputies were on patrol in a residential neighborhood around 3 p.m. when they spotted a man on a bicycle committing a traffic violation. When they tried to stop him, they say he dropped the bike and ran. And when the deputies caught up to him a block later, they say he punched one of them in the face. And as he did, dropped some clothes he had been carrying. And at that point, according to sheriff's officials, the deputies saw a gun amongst those clothes and both the deputies opened fire.
And then chaos broke loose right after that, right?
Yeah, it did. It appears several people were out and about at that time. It was around 3 p.m., as I said. And there are a number of videos on social media of the man running through the neighborhood. None of the videos catch the shooting itself, but this one captures the moments after the killing.
They smoked me. That's crazy. They shot 20 times. Auntie, come over here, Auntie. Watch out. Look, aired him out.
The Department A has denied he was shot 20 times, but hasn't said how many shots were fired or how many hit the man. In the video, you can see the man lying face down next to some cars as deputies approach him with their guns drawn.
What about the person who was shot? What do we know about this person?
We don't know much. Social media and Black Lives Matter have identified him as Dejon Kizzy. Some reports put his age at 20, others at 33. Sheriff Alex Villanueva said in remarks to the Board of Supervisors today that he was the cousin of someone who works at the department. We'll likely learn more about him later today. There are reports his family will be at a protest this evening outside the South LA Sheriff's Station.
And Black Lives Matter sent out an urgent call yesterday for people to protest, and they did into the wee hours, really, during a tense confrontation with sheriff's deputies. Why are critics particularly angry about this shooting?
Well, they say even if Kizzy had a gun, that he dropped it, that he was unarmed at the time both deputies opened fire. Here's Black Lives Matter leader Melina Abdullah.
At the time they shot, he had already dropped the gun, according to their own story. According to their own story, he did not have a gun when they killed him.
She also notes there have been other disturbing shootings by the Sheriff's Department, including that of 18-year-old Andres Guardado earlier this year, a couple of miles from where Kizzy was shot. The coroner's report said Guardado was shot five times in the back. Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas today on that shooting introduced a motion calling for an independent medical inquiry into the Guardado shooting, which would involve public hearings on it. So it would be a very public event. He's looking to make this a public inquiry into the Guardado shooting. And then there's another. Last year, deputies fatally shot 24-year-old Ryan Twyman, who was unarmed. In both cases, activists raised questions about whether the deputies involved in another issue for this department, whether these deputies were involved in groups that are deputy gangs within the department.
Yeah, Frank, the LA County Sheriff's Department is taking a lot of heat right now.
Yeah, it is. And it appears to be trying to craft its narrative after each of these shootings. For instance, there was a tweet after the shooting of Dejon Kizzy that said the suspect produced a handgun, while the lead detective said the gun was among some clothes that Dejon Kizzy dropped. So you can kind of hear the subtle difference there, you know, produced a handgun versus a handgun dropping to the ground among some clothes. In neighborhoods where these shootings occur, there remains deep frustration, as is across the country. This is in part not just of the shootings themselves, but how Black men are treated after they've been killed, says Black Lives Matter's Melina Abdullah.
When we got there, he was still uncovered in the streets. So just the complete lack of humanity.
The sheriff's department, by the way, said it didn't cover the body right away because it was still investigating the shooting. That likely didn't provide much solace for the family and the people who witnessed the shooting.
And just to be clear, no body cam video of the shooting. Sheriff's Department does not have body cams. That is supposed to change, Frank.
Yeah. The Board of Supervisors was set to vote just today to approve the funding to begin outfitting deputies with body cams. The rollout is set to begin next month. The department says it will take about 18 months to put a camera on every patrol deputy.
That's KPECC's public safety reporter, Frank Stoltz. Frank, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Ed.
All right, there aren't as many kids enrolled in LA schools right now, with the littlest learners, their numbers, being thinned out the most. Now, under pre-pandemic days, fewer students enrolled at say, LAUSD would mean less money for the school district. But state lawmakers had an answer for all that earlier this year to try and help out these schools. But that, in turn, created another problem, which now needs another fix. And state lawmakers are introducing a bill to try and fix what they needed to fix before. It's all coming up next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm Amy Martinez. Despite shifting most learning online, college campuses have opened their dorms to thousands of students. And what's followed is an increase in coronavirus cases being reported. Just yesterday, California State University Chico canceled a limited number of in-person classes and asked students to vacate shared housing after at least 30 people tested positive for the virus. KPCC's Adolfo Guzman Lopez reports that some Southern California campuses are taking more stringent measures to avoid such outbreaks.
UCLA is expecting hundreds of students to move into the dorms. It'll test all of them. Those who test positive will have to isolate for 2 weeks. UC Irvine's requiring students to show written proof of a negative COVID test before move-in. Administrators say the steps are needed to avoid outbreaks like those plaguing college campuses across the nation. UC Irvine senior Dominic Pastorell plans to move into the dorms. He has hope that his classmates can do it.
We have to have a common goal, and hopefully we're all focused on being here to better our lives.
Cal State campuses aren't requiring COVID tests, but schools in both systems are banning outside visitors to on-campus housing. Campus outbreaks have been spreading across the nation, including at USC, where administrators last week reported what they called an alarming increase in students testing positive for COVID. Administrators are urging students to practice social distancing, but 7 Cal Poly Pomona students who just moved into different dorms a few weeks ago ignored that advice. They had a Friday night party.
In all honesty, I was a little disappointed.
Justin Kiryu de la Cruz lives in the dorms as a resident advisor.
But at the same time, I feel for them, you know. You want to have that first-year college experience.
Administrators at Cal Poly Pomona say a COVID-19 outbreak in their dorms has higher consequences. It's opened a limited number of dorm rooms to students who are homeless, low-income, or have poor Wi-Fi where they live. If the dorms close because of an outbreak, they'll have few, if any, options. Covering higher education, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez.
All right, now to what's going on in K through 12 education. Enrollment is down across Los Angeles Unified, especially in the lowest grades, due in part to the pandemic and the online schooling it's brought about. Now, normally the fact that there are 6,000 fewer kindergartners across LAUSD would have dire consequences for funding, but state legislators bent the rules earlier this year so public schools could get through these unprecedented times. However, that created a different set of problems that lawmakers are now trying to fix with a new bill. Here to explain what we have is KPCC's education reporter, Kyle Stokes. Now, Kyle, before we get to this bill I just referenced, let's talk a bit about enrollment. It's been falling for years across LAUSD, but this drop that we're talking about is pretty big. So can you remind us, why does enrollment matter?
Yeah, I mean, enrollment equals funding is the short answer. Schools in California are funded for the actual number of students that are attending classes in their classrooms. And so that's that's what's happening and why in, you know, normal years, this drop in kindergarten enrollment would be seen as such a shock, because that is 6,000 fewer students that the district would eventually be getting funding for. Now, as you're sort of referencing, the legislature sort of, it, you know, was worried about what would happen, you know, with the COVID-19 crisis. And so what they've done this year is basically, you know, say that they were going to freeze funding at last year's funding levels, so that a school district like LAUSD that might take otherwise a huge hit to its enrollment, you know, projections, which, you know, again, these are kindergartners we're talking about, this loss in enrollment compounds year over year, that districts like that wouldn't have to worry about it for this year, at least. Now, that's created some more problems that we can talk about, but, you know, basically the state is trying to suspend this normal rule of operation, which is that enrollment equals funding that is used to fund schools across California.
Yeah. This drop should not affect funding formulas right now, right? I mean, I know funding is directly related to how many kids are in school, but technically not in this case, right?
Yeah, not in this case, because of this hold harmless provision. Yeah. And there's also that, you know, normally every single year schools get sort of a grace period where a student, if they have declining enrollment, it usually takes a year for that money to sort of drop off of their books. But again, if we're talking about kindergartners, that, you know, this is money that's going to fall away from the district conceivably, you know, that those students aren't going to return. And that's sort of the concern that compounds, and that LAUSD is still going to have to worry about. The difference here we're talking about is kindergartners. Kindergarten in California is not mandatory. And so it's possible that, you know, these students will enroll once it comes time for first grade, but because of the pandemic and all of the stress associated with distance learning, it's just that parents are saying they don't want to deal with that this year. So that's one of the possible phenomena that we're seeing going on with this drop in kindergarten enrollment.
Now, Kyle, everything we've been talking about turns out had some unintended consequences. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So if you hold schools funding at their last year's level, that's great if you're a school that doesn't have, that is, you know, has declining enrollment. But for a school that has increasing enrollment, that's a really big problem to have your enrollment held at last year's level, because it means you're getting less money. Essentially, you know, you think about a lot of, you know, school districts in growing suburban communities. I mean, Irvine, for one, Redondo Beach. These are school districts that, you know, Hemet, parts of the Inland Empire. These are districts that have, you know, burgeoning enrollments. And it also is a really big hit to charter schools, especially new ones that add an entire grade level every year. Some of them, as you know, their sixth graders be turned into seventh graders. The school just opens up a seventh grade to accommodate them. And that's a common scenario in a lot of charter schools. And so the hold harmless provision that the legislature enacted would have been a big problem for all of the above that I just mentioned. But essentially, the legislature has come up with a fix at this point.
All right. So what is that fix?
The fix is that they are going to allow for schools to claim some of the funding that they would have otherwise, you know, been able to accept if, you know, their enrollment were growing as normal, if we were funding them as normal, that the dollars followed the student. So there is going to be a little bit of an acknowledgement that that these schools' enrollments are growing, and a little bit of assistance for these schools. It's based on a somewhat complicated formula, but it's, you know, getting a little bit closer to making these districts and charter schools whole.
So, okay, so charters aren't thrilled with this fix, but if I recall, and you reported on this, a number of charter schools applied for PPP money too. So what's been the state's response to that?
Yeah, well, I think that's partially why the response from the legislature here was not more generous. And just to sort of dig in on this just a little bit, the reason that there are still some people unhappy with this legislative compromise, especially from the charter school community, is that essentially the state will only fund a growing school based on the whichever is lower of the numbers that they were budgeting for, that they were projecting, or the number of students that actually showed up. So if you wrote a conservative budget, if you were trying to be fiscally responsible and not assuming that you were going to hit some ambitious wild growth target, you essentially get penalized for that. And so there are a lot of charter schools that are not happy about that. And in fact, a group of charter schools that are suing over that provision, and they're going to continue the lawsuit because they're mad about being penalized for being, they would say, fiscally responsible. On the other element is that virtual charter schools are not allowed to take credit for enrollment. So they are not eligible for this new funding, and that remains a sore spot for charter schools as well. But as you said, the defense to that is, A, we don't have unlimited money right now. We feel like it's the schools with declining enrollment, the districts with declining enrollment, particularly big urban systems, that are probably more in need of that money. That's the assumption that legislative leaders and apparently the Newsom administration are making in this time. And they also say, as you mentioned, yes, like charter schools had access to PPP money, mm-hmm. so particularly to the charter schools that are concerned about this. The state's response is that charter schools had access to these low interest paycheck protection loans that were available to small businesses and nonprofits, but not to public school districts. And so there's a bit of an effort to equalize in that, and that was made explicit in their justification for not being a little bit more generous toward these growing schools.
That's KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
I don't know, we're all trying to stay indoors because of the pandemic and because there aren't too many fun things to do outside anyway. But this weekend in particular, this one that's coming up, you really need to stay indoors because you might actually melt if you set a foot outside. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. If you've been enjoying this cool and gorgeous weather, sorry to say the good times are over, because this weekend we're going to get slammed by another heat wave, which doesn't only mean we'll be burning up, but at the risk of wildfires, yeah, that's kind of probably going to go through the roof. And of course, for that, we have KPCC science reporter Jacob Margolis here to tell us all about it. So, Jacob, how hot is it going to be this weekend? You better have a good joke for that one.
I don't have a joke. I don't joke about 120 degrees possible in Palm Springs, 115 possible in the San Fernando Valley where I'm at. But those areas, we kind of expect high temperatures, not usually that high, but very high, 100 plus in the valley. One of the scariest parts of this whole thing and this whole heat wave is that we're going to also see a potential 105 in downtown LA, 103, somewhere around there, and 90 plus possible near the beach. You know, those are areas where air conditioning may be less common and health is more of a concern.
Yeah, the beach is where people can escape to, right, Jacob? But now you can't really if it's going to be 90 near the beach. And that's all that sounds terrifyingly dangerous for people that don't have AC, right?
Yeah, it could very. This looks like it could very well be a public health crisis, especially for people in low-income areas and unhoused people. The other aspect of this that caught my eye that could exacerbate that problem even more are the high nighttime temperatures. Those in some areas could be 80-plus degrees outside. So that means that if you don't have AC, you know, whereas maybe you cooled down when night fell before, there's a possibility that you won't have that opportunity at night. So those people, a lot of people won't be able to cool off, and that actually leaves them more medically vulnerable. We're talking a risk of heat stroke, obviously, possibly exacerbating things like heart and respiratory conditions. It's really scary. And that's why when we're addressing climate change and extreme heat waves, these extreme heat events, we need to talk about social inequality as well, because it's most likely to impact those who are without. Now, temperatures are expected to peak on Sunday, but could stick around, you know, in the valleys and the deserts for a bit longer than that, maybe midweek. We're going to have to see. I'm really, 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 really hoping that the power doesn't go out again and that we can maintain so that people can use air conditioning.
Oh yeah, well, medications that are in fridges, that's a huge one right there. Now, along with the high heat comes increased risk of wildfire. So how are things looking on that front?
Yeah, I'll start this one off by saying it is a holiday weekend. It's going to be hot and dry. 95% of wildfires are started in California by people. So don't mess this up for everyone and start a fire, everyone out there. The reason high temperatures are such a huge concern for fires is that the hot weather, it dries things out. It makes them more flammable. But really, everything in Southern California, or a lot of stuff in Southern California, is already pretty dry. Those medium and small fuels are pretty dry. The other thing that happens when the air is hot is that, the ambient air heats up the plants and trees, whatever, and it takes less energy for those fuels to then reach the point where they catch on fire. So the fire can spread more easily. The heat is also really hard on firefighters. There is a chance we could see similar, those really big, we saw these over the Lake Fire, pyrocumulus clouds form. And when those do, they can actually create their own sporadic winds, which can push fire all over the place, and so those can be particularly dangerous as well.
Any thunderstorms that we might see that might start hundreds of fires in California again?
It doesn't look like we will see a bunch of thunderstorms, but there is always the possibility. There appears to be less moisture associated with this event, so it'll also probably be a bit less humid. Last time we had the remnants of a tropical storm come up, and those lightning strikes like what we saw are pretty rare. We don't get them that way that often, but like I said, you know, always a possibility.
Yeah, there was like 13,000 lightning strikes. At least that was the last count I got from Cal Fire that they were dealing with up in Northern California. Now, speaking of fighting fires, our wildlife resources have recently been maxed out by all the fires. So where are those at?
Yeah, in case people don't know, we literally maxed out all available options when the fires were in full swing. That doesn't mean we couldn't have brought in maybe a couple more crews here and there, but we had the National Guard in, we had people flying in from other countries, I mean, 8 other states. As of right now, there are 19 incidents in Northern and Southern California that are still being taken care of. Nearly 15,000 firefighting personnel are in California fighting fires. That's out of 25,000 across the whole U.S., so we have most of them here. The good news is that a lot of the incidents are winding down, and they're slowly starting to pull, you know, a person here or there, 10 people, 20 people here or there off of them. But all of these firefighters and, you know, people that man the dozers and the helicopters, they've been going and going and going, and fatigue has become a major issue. So the hope is that, you know, maybe they're getting some rest, they're starting to get rotated out, and more air resources will be available, more trucks, dozers, what have you, will be available as, you know, those fires kind of start to wind down. The hope is that we don't get anything near what we had during the last heat wave with this one.
That's KPCC science reporter Jacob Margolis. Jacob, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All All right, now let's talk about fire as an object of art and catharsis. While we mourn the loss of life and property, when a wildfire tears through our communities, there's also a part of us that's really irresistibly drawn to its immense power. That terrifying beauty is the subject of a local exhibit called Facing Fire, Art, Wildfire, and the End of Nature in the New West. It's on display at the Photography Museum of California in Riverside, which is set to reopen in October. Now, among the featured pieces, which are also currently online, are the works of photojournalists who have dedicated their careers to documenting fire, and the work by artist Anna Meyer, who harnessed fire to create her sculptures, and Norma Quintana, who created a kind of memorial from the scorched remains of a fire that actually could have killed her. Here for more, Take Two contributor Stephen Cuevas has the story.
There are some images that have come to define California in the public's imagination. Think the sweeping vistas of 19th century painter Albert Bierstadt, or Ansel Adams's iconic black and white images of the Yosemite Valley. Photojournalist Stuart Paley visits some of these same locations when they're on fire.
And in some ways, this is almost sort of a rebellion against those pictures of Ansel Adams or the paintings of Thomas Miranda in the 19th century, which have influenced the work I do in Are Beautiful, but in many ways are this sort of colonial romanticized view of California that isn't necessarily accurate and doesn't take into account the fact that this range of climates that we have is very much influenced by forces of nature.
Paley is just 30 years old, but he's already a seasoned wildfire photographer, having shot dozens over the past 8 years. He doesn't just capture the flames tearing across scorched ridgelines and rooftops. He also trains his camera on the unburned, fragile open spaces that are increasingly under threat from infernos spurred by development, drought, and climate change. In one image, a grove of silhouetted Joshua trees are lit by distant firelight and a radiant desert night sky.
Fire is its own distinct light source that's constantly changing, and it is a very warm-toned, and that warmth of the fire often contrasts with the blue tones of the sky at night. And one of my favorite artists is Vincent van Gogh, and a quote that's attributed to him is, "I often think that the night is more colorful than the day." And for me, fire sort of embody those pastel paintings of the starry night or some things like that. We see some of the aftermath shots over there, or Norma Quintana's work. It's a much more monochromatic palette. It's all ash and gray.
Paley's talking about the Napa-based artist Norma Quintana. In 2017, the three-story home she shared with her family burned to the ground in the ferocious Atlas Peak fire. From those ashes, with black gloves covering her hands, she plucked the materials used to construct a deeply personal work.
There's a Madonna, or the top of a Madonna, doorknobs, some spoons.
Veteran Southern California photographer Douglas McCullough is the curator of the Facing Fire exhibit.
So she sifted out these things, which for her are really not objects, they're actually memories. Yeah. And she set it on a black glove, and she took a photo with the only camera that she had that survived, which was her iPhone. So there's an entire wall of iPhone photos of burned objects that she sifted out of her destroyed studio and house.
Most of these artists and photojournalists created work reacting to fire. But Texas-based sculptor Anna Meyer deliberately collaborated with fire for a series called Fistful of Fear. In 2008, she shaped 12 ceramic slabs, each one engraved with a different inscription. But instead of firing the pieces the traditional way, in a kiln, she carried the unfired ceramics into a potential fire zone.
In 2008, I placed them in the canyons in and around Malibu, so that they might eventually be fired by a wildfire.
10 years after the ceramic pieces were placed, the 2018 Woolsey Fire swept through the canyons, destroying hundreds of homes. Some of the ceramic pieces were also lost to the fire, but six survived.
I mean, I felt really sick about it all. I mean, it was a horrible fire. And, you know, over that decade, I never wished for fire. And the way that the project lived was as a conceptual gesture. It just kind of lived in people's imaginations. So, yeah, it's complicated. And it actually took a while before I really started thinking about what it meant now that there were these objects that had been fired.
I've been working with fires since 2006, and they've gotten worse every year. My name's Samantha Fields. I'm a painter living in Los Angeles, and I have 3 large paintings and 44 small paintings in the show. And the paintings are acrylic on canvas. I make them with an airbrush. For the most part, I paint atmosphere with atmosphere.
One of Fields' larger paintings is based on photos that she shot during a nasty brush fire that broke out at the edge of Magic Mountain a few years ago. The canvas captures the moment she spotted a little boy on a bike who had stopped to watch the flames lick at the edges of the amusement park's skyscraping roller coasters.
This one hit me really hard. You know, this child's the future. So this is the person that's going to be dealing with the ramifications of climate change and drought and heat waves and all of these different things that we deal with.
Fields also includes a series of tightly framed 6-square-inch canvases that focus on minute details of about 32 different California wildfires. The pieces mimic the hazy, hallucinogenic effect experienced when in the midst of a wildfire.
And I moved to this kind of small square format because of the language we use when we describe fire containment. The fire is 80% contained, you know, et cetera. This idea of it being contained within this tiny square, taking this kind of epic thing and smashing it down to a much smaller size, was an idea I was playing with in this series of work.
Fire is an elemental force that humanity is directly linked with.
Again, the curator of Facing Fire, Douglas McCullough.
Other elemental forces you could list, like an earthquake or a flood or tornado. The difference is you can't, like, let a hurricane loose, right? But we can cause a fire. Mankind has this link with fire as an elemental force that is somehow beyond all these others. We are enabled by fire. We're created by fire.
Facing Fire, Art, Wildfire, and the End of Nature in the New West is at the California Museum of Photography in Riverside through early 2021. The exhibit had to close down at the start of the pandemic. Curators hope to have it reopened soon. For Take Two, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
All right, there are some corners in the U.S. where you can see a brand new movie inside a theater, you know, like the good old days. But in L.A. County, that is not happening quite yet. However, the host of the LAS Studios podcast, Hollywood a Sequel, John Horn, well, John Horn will not be denied. So he took a road trip to Las Vegas to see Tenet, and he's going to tell us all about the experience. John Horn coming up next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC, and you can get this show as a podcast on Apple Podcasts and on the KPCC app. I'm A. Martinez. All right, how far would you go to see a movie in a theater? Well, John Horn, host of the LA Studios podcast Hollywood the Sequel, drove out to Las Vegas to get the big screen experience of Christopher Nolan's Tenet. So before we get to your thoughts on the movie, I'm very curious to hear what the experience of being in a theater was like. Because for me, John, it's been a long, long time. So walk us through your night last night. Where'd you see it and what was the scene there?
I saw it at a Cinemark theater called the Century 16 South Point. And it's inside a casino, the South Point Hotel Casino. So the way you go in there is you walk through the casino, as you always have to do, and you take an escalator up to the theater. So you leave this kind of smell of cigarette smoke and desperation and despair, and you go up the elevator, and the first thing you smell is movie popcorn. And the nostalgic sense of smell is so powerful that it just kind of released this great feeling like I'm back where I need to be and I'm leaving everything else behind.
Isn't that amazing, John? Because I could smell popcorn popping anywhere else and I won't feel anything. I smell that smell inside a theater, like somewhere outside or near the concession stand. And you're right, I get that old feeling of just being in love with watching a movie inside a theater.
And I got a big thing of popcorn. So I went right in and got my popcorn.
Good. Did you refill it at least once?
No refill. Oh. So this is one of the things that you notice when you go in. So the way they have figured out how to kind of keep things reasonable is they don't sell a lot of seats. So when I went to go buy my seat for Tenet, it automatically blocks out the seat next to you. I saw it in a 250-seat theater with recliner chairs, but they only sold 50 seats. So the theater itself was really empty. I don't think there was anybody within 7 seats of me. And there are signs everywhere about what you should do, how to wear your mask, which is really tricky when you're trying to eat popcorn. Yeah. And each theater, I think there are 16 screens at this theater, had its own pandemic usher. They call it the chief clean and safety monitor, somebody who's coming in, making sure that people are socially distanced, that they're wearing their masks, and all of those things. So it actually didn't feel that dangerous. Obviously, it's safer just to stay at home, but it didn't feel like I was taking a big risk.
Were you close enough to talk to anyone while you were there?
Yeah, I talked to a bunch of people going into the theater, which was a little tricky. I set up my own sound system, socially distanced with a boom mic, so I wasn't in anybody's space. I talked to a lot of people who were getting out for the first time. So Bradley and Sean Kenny are a father and son from Las Vegas, and here's what they had to say about going back to the theater.
It was touted as being the movie to bring back theaters, so I figured why not go and go the first night that it's available. And you never feel safe, of course, but I feel like this is one thing I'm willing to risk it for, you know?
I think it's an acceptable risk. I'm a big Chris Nolan fan. Memento was captivating from the beginning, and I just love good movies.
Before, it was just risking whether the movie was good or bad. Now it's actually a real health risk to decide to go to the movies.
Yeah, the National Association of Theater Owners, which is kind of the lobbying and organizational body for exhibitors, did an announcement a couple weeks ago where they talked about Cinema Safe, which is an industry-wide protocol. They had a couple of doctors on talking about safety. And one of the doctors said it is not 100% safe, because it isn't. You're with other people. You don't know where they've been. That said, if you look closely at some of the protocols in place, it feels pretty safe. So if you go to like the concession stand, there are no condiments for hot dogs. You have to ask for them. So there's no shared soda fountain machine. There are no refills. You can't use cash, just cards. And there's reminders everywhere about wearing masks and keeping socially distanced. And even as you're in the theater, there are reminders of what it means to be smart about your safety and health. And it is very interesting. They showed a bunch of previews of coming attractions, but one of the last previews was a Cinemark ad where they showed in a tiny, tiny frame on the big screen a scene from Wonder Woman, the next Wonder Woman film, and then it blew up to full screen. It's like, this is how you should be watching movies, not at home on your little TV.
That is very effective. You were just saying it to me. It's a very effective way of getting me maybe back into the theater. So it sounds like you felt okay. And you know what? I got to admit, John, that's going to go a long way, because I do want to see Wonder Woman on a big screen. Wonder Woman 1984, the next Wonder Woman movie. So yeah, maybe that'll be the one that will kind of pull me back in. We're talking to John Horn. He's the host of the LAS Studios podcast, Hollywood the Sequel, joining us from Las Vegas, where he went to see Tenet. Now, all right, John, so that's the movie-going experience. What about the movie itself, without any spoilers? I mean, what can you say about it?
So it stars Robert Pattinson, John David Washington, Elizabeth Debicki, and Kenneth Branagh as a great evil Russian oligarch. That sounds maybe repetitive, but that's who he plays. And it's really about time and what happens in the future and how it can shape the present. And it touches on something called the grandfather paradox, which is if you travel back in time and kill your own grandfather before he has fathered one of your parents, how are you even alive to go back in time? Hence the paradox. Crazy, crazy car chase scenes. There's a battle scene where people are walking backward in time and forward in time. It's crazy. It's really well done. And it was a great sound system, so it felt really loud. It was nothing that you could see at home.
Now, John, for your podcast, Hollywood the Sequel, you've been talking with people for the last few months about how the entertainment industry may change due to the pandemic and forced stoppage of all things. So what did this journey to see Tenet in Las Vegas tell you about maybe what the film industry needs to do to renew confidence in the public and seeing movies in theaters? People like me, people in the public that want to go but are still worried.
There is some risk, and Tenet is a very expensive movie. I mean, it cost probably $200 million to make. And the fact that 50 people are in an auditorium that could seat 250, that big theaters across the country, like in New York and California, aren't open, whether or not Warner Brothers makes their money back is going to be a little iffy. But the fact that people are showing up and that it does feel safe, I think is a really good sign. Of course, if there's an outbreak in a theater, if there's some sort of cluster where a lot of people get sick going to the movies, that's going to change it. But right now, it does feel like this is the beginning of what could be happening.
Now, okay, finally, you're getting close to the end of your limited run podcast. So what sorts of conversations do you have on the show this week?
We talk with David Rubin, and he is the president of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. So there's the one question about, like, what do the Oscars look like going forward? And I think the Academy is really trying to figure that out. Will it be televised? They've changed eligibility rules. Movies don't have to premiere in theaters. But David Rubin is a casting director. And so much of our podcast has been about equity and inclusion and representation. David Rubin is really pushing to make sure that any kind of descriptor that limits the opportunities for actors to play in a part should be eliminated.
The focus should not be on those descriptors. It should be on how that character impacts the narrative. What job do they do in the telling of the story? And if you focus only on that, it opens up a myriad of possibilities in terms of age, in terms of gender, in terms of race. And casting directors have been hip to this for a long time, and our job is to open the minds up of our directors and our producers and our studio executives to point out that this particular role doesn't need to be a white guy in his 40s.
And listen, Tenet stars John David Washington. There is no descriptor in this plot of whether or not this lead character is white or black. This is Denzel Washington's son. You might have seen him in Black Klansman. I'm not going to just tell you what his job is in this film, but he is the man. In fact, there are a couple references in the script where he says, "I am the protagonist in this story," and he is, and he's great at it.
And that's all. That's the only description we have of him. That at least that I've seen, John. Protagonist. That's it.
That is it.
That's John Horn, host of the LAS Studios podcast, Hollywood the Sequel, and you can get it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Abe.
All right, and while you're there looking for Hollywood the Sequel, why don't you look over and look for your old pals Take Two. We're also there as well. You can listen to today's show, yesterday's show, last week, whatever you want. We are there for you. We're also on Twitter, at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.